Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents First Train Out of Denver by Leo Jenkins. Narrated by Corey M. Snow. No words quite describe the feeling that washes over you as you're walking out the door, leaving behind all you know, and hitting the open road with your balls on your sleeve. Stephanie Scoveland. Chapter 1. Mile High Mission. How vain it is to sit down to write when you have not stood up to live. Henry David Thoreau. My right knee sinks an inch into the soft sand under the weight of the burdensome pack upon my back. The straps torment my tired shoulders. My senses are awake. A particular heightened vigilance rekindles in me. The moon provides perfect illumination for tonight's mission. Covering my sector, scanning from left to right for any possible threats, another ranger behind me does the same. The two of us survey the shadows. The scent of something resembling smoldering sawdust hangs in the air. With the ferocity of a war drum, the percussion of my pounding heart sends shockwaves throughout my tense body. If we get caught, we're done for. This is being alive. This feeling, this edge of everything we breathe for. The cool night air delicately lifts the sweat from my neck, sending a chill down my spine, knowing there's no promise of safety on second-hand wings. It's just past midnight, and we're using an old boxcar for cover in a train yard as we wait for the right time to board an eastbound vessel. The cool breeze is a surprise for a June evening in Denver. The fresh coffee in my travel mug helps stave off the cold. It also does well to sober me up. Who gets drunk at a baby shower, I think to myself, as I shake off the incoming nausea. Handing the mug back to Marty, he gladly takes a sip. At nearly 6.5 feet tall, Marty is an imposing force even while on a knee. The thick red beard covering his baby face tries desperately to conceal his grinning anticipation. Marty, a soon-to-be first-time father, makes his presence on this mission seemingly reckless. Marty whispers over his shoulder to me, "It's time!" Instinctively, we transition from security mode into a direct-action mentality. Operating under the cover of darkness in hostile environments isn't new for either of us. We know the risk as well as what's at stake. Marty takes the lead and climbs between two train cars. I stay within an arm's distance of his pack. The margin for error here is non-existent. Neither one of us has prior experience stowing away on a train, a fact easily recognizable by anyone watching the awkward nature in which we climb aboard the last car of a very long chain. The walkway along the push car is so narrow that our packs drag against the side of the train on our left and the short rail on our right as we make our way to the door. Marty clumsily fumbles with the door as we both stand gracelessly exposed in the ever-increasing beams of vibrant moonlight. "We're in!" he finally exclaims. Our heaving breaths separate the seconds. We each look around to see if the clamor our brimming bags made alerted anyone to our location. The minutes seem like hours waiting for the train to depart. After nearly half an hour sitting in a motionless silence, we let our guard down a little. If anyone spotted us boarding, we'd be caught by now. The fatigue of too many late nights catches up to me now, too many nights searching for comfort at the bottom of a bottle. My eyelids become magnetic, drawing toward each other like an unstoppable force of nature. Just as they soothingly connect, the heavy metal train door swings open. The backlit outline figure of a man appears from nowhere. Quite calmly, he asks, "Can you turn on that light for me?" Marty finds the switch and follows the man's request. The stranger leans over and grabs a clipboard hanging from the wall that escaped our notice in the blackout conditions. The ragged conductor signs a form, places the clipboard back in its place and says, "Have a good night, guys," then closes the door behind him. After the longest 30 seconds of silence in my adult life, Marty shatters our collective reticence. "Well, that was odd. I can't help but think we're being set up somehow. The discussion begins if we should exit the train. We decide we should just stay put. If he wanted us off, he would have told us to leave, right?" He didn't even act surprised that we're here. We decide to just stay in place. Despite the excitement, the weight of exhaustion pulls me back down. It doesn't take long before my eyelids slam shut once more. Using an old tan jacket as a pillow, I sprawl out on the floor of the pushcar and wait for the train to begin moving. I fall into a deep sleep, the kind where it doesn't matter what position your body is in or how hard the surface is you're passed out on. 2 hours of hard sleep later, and the train hasn't budged. Marty is not finding any more comfort in his awkward position, propped against the back door. The door flings open. My slumber is disturbed without sympathy. The all-too-familiar, authoritative voice of a law enforcement officer commands us off the train. He wields the brightest flashlight I've ever experienced, shocking my rods and cones into submission. Marty piles out instantly. I choose to move slowly and deliberately. I know what this looks like, and I'm not willing to get shot tonight. Collecting the now filthy tan jacket from the dirty floor, I lift my hands to show the officer I have no weapon, put on my jacket, and hoist the large red backpack to my stiff shoulders. I follow Marty's lead, making 3 steps through the darkness and out of the cramped train door. Sitting on a pile of stones like 2 overgrown teenagers out past curfew, the lecture from the officer about trespassing begins. I'm not paying attention. All I can think about is the last time I was arrested for trespassing and how expensive it was. What am I even doing here? I ask myself. A week ago, I lived in an amazing beach house in Costa Rica. Now I'm homeless, unemployed, and about to be arrested for train hopping at midnight in Denver, Colorado. Chapter 2. Breaking the Ice. Once you make a decision, the universe conspires to make it happen. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Trudging through the tenebrous morning, 2 feet of sticky, wet snow compresses under my feet. Hours before the sun makes its presence felt, I reach for the frozen handle of my Dodge Dakota parked on the street in front of my small house. My mind is post-op Novocaine numb as I knock the obnoxious, freezing white substance from my shoes for the countless time. The ever-advancing army of unique snowflakes descending upon me seems to halt mid-freefall. In a moment of suspended animation and brilliant clarity, a single thought dominates my cognition, changing my trajectory irrevocably. I don't want to go to work today. That's it. I don't know a single adult who hasn't had the same thought echo through their mind. For several years, I've owned and managed a modest gym in Colorado, a role I fell into by accident. My love of fitness and inability to take senseless orders following my time in the Army set the stage for my entrepreneurship. I've worked hard building this life, brick by brick. It's my blood, my sweat, I've made mortar from the mix, smearing the emotional sealant upon an otherwise porous foundation, burning my soul to build a castle so grand. Misplaced stones yield a labyrinth in its stead, one I now find myself unintentionally at the center of. I've grown weary, exhausted from the tedium, a life maintained in a perpetual gray tent, shadowed by the walls of my own creation. As the frozen air blasts through the vents and converts to a temperature capable of melting the frost on the windshield, I think back to a simple promise I made to a friend years before. I wasn't there when James was killed in Iraq. In the days and weeks afterward, I fell into an absolute abyss. In the wake of that tragedy, I made a promise to my fallen friend and to every one of my brothers who never came home from war. I will do everything in my power to honor their memories by living life to the fullest. Too many of the best and brightest of our generation were robbed the opportunity to choose how they'd spend their 20s and beyond. The best way to honor them is to fulfill my promise. As the virgin snow melodically crunches under the tread of my all-terrain tires, headlights illuminate the path and the solution becomes evident. Unknowingly, I've waited for this moment all my life and more. Life is too short, too damn precious to spend miserable. Before arriving at the gym, less than 3 minutes later, my exit strategy takes form. I will throw caution and myself into the wind. The next few months become as transformative as any I have ever experienced in my 3 decades on Earth. We are taught there's a certain way to do things. Take out loans to go to school, get a job, pay your taxes, get married, buy a house, fill it with things you can't afford, have kids, raise the kids to go to school, continue working at the job that you no longer enjoy to pay off the schooling and possessions you didn't really need until you have saved enough to retire so you can finally enjoy life. Now, more than ever, this pattern sours my stomach. There's something backward about it. Why do we put off living life until tomorrow when it's looking us in the eye today? After all, time is our most finite resource. It is the only thing we can't reproduce. Yet we foolishly burn it, an ignorant defiance to mortality. When we see death, we beg for more time, not for more money or possessions or power. No, we plead for moments. Go ahead, make your retirement plans. Life doesn't give a shit about your plans, and I no longer give a shit about fitting into that ordained mold. To be lasting, the change must be drastic. To find myself now, I have to lose myself, to purge the synthetic layers of discontent and the weight of possession. I decide to sell everything I own, minus what will fit, in a single backpack. What I can't sell, I give away. The first things to go are items from when I raced triathlon, some race wheels, old shoes, and other gadgets. I haven't used any of it in a couple of years. Even though they've done nothing but collect dust for years, parting with them is tough. I made incredible memories on those wheels. I reminisce about all the miles they carried me and the races I'd won on them. Maybe it's not the object I'm attached to at all. Perhaps it's the experiences I cling to. My snowboard gear is the next to go. After working at a few outdoor stores over the years, my house resembles an REI. Every piece of equipment carried me through a different adventure. These possessions, a roadmap of my life, define me as a person, or so I once thought. The more I release, the easier the process becomes, selling high-end outdoor gear for pennies on the dollar. 4 snowboards, 3 bikes, a house full of furniture, and more Gore-Tex than an expedition of 5 needs to summit Everest, all goes. What doesn't sell quickly, I start to give away until the contents of my life fits into the pack sitting in the corner of my now empty bedroom. Every day, parting ways with my possessions becomes easier. What remains difficult is attempting to explain to the people around me what I'm doing and why. I'm met with a barrage of doubt-filled resistance and brimming insecurities from several people. My actions don't fit their mold, and that creates discomfort. That discomfort manifests into mild mocking and belittlement. For years, I clung to the belief that many people depend on my presence. My leaving them results in an egregious abandonment. The truth is, people are resilient, and if they truly care for you, they will support your decision, even if it creates a minor inconvenience for them. If they don't support it, then they never actually cared about you to begin with, and their opinions should not factor into how you decide to live. The process inadvertently teaches me an exceptionally valuable lesson. People who interject their petty wants into a life decision that's ultimately in your best interest, which does not concern them, who do not love you and will likely not show up when you need them, are best off ignored, if not disregarded entirely. Over a few glasses of whiskey, I work out a deal to sell my business to a friend named Todd, who I know will not just sustain but improve the already successful gym. Todd is probably the smartest meathead I've ever met. Well into those brilliant years of life where his arms still fully stretch the sleeves of his shirt, the color of his neatly trimmed beard has given way to the distinguished white of an experienced man. He's that guy you know, who everyone likes. 24 hours after being placed up for sale, I hand over the keys to my pickup truck. For the past year, I lived with a close friend named Yasin. We served in the military together several years prior. Born in Bulgaria, Yasin immigrated to the United States at a young age and maintained his bilingual ability, a skill I envy. He moved out to Colorado from Florida with nothing but his cantankerous old dog, Dutch, and a pile of clothes. he becomes the joyous bulk beneficiary of all my household goods, a mutually beneficial exchange, as he isn't really the type to shop for plates, and I have no desire to haggle with some stranger at a yard sale over an item that costs a dollar. I hand over the house key to Iason. There's no sleep the evening before my flight. A thousand loose ends needing tied tangle into a giant, chaotic knot. Bank, phone, insurance, and countless papers to sign. The process, a caffeine-fueled cyclone, moves too fast for emotion or even much thought to creep in. My sleepless night turns to day, and the list still isn't complete. T-minus 15 hours to departure. I want my last day in Denver to be spent leisurely strolling through the museums I was always too busy to visit. Instead, I sit in a familiar cafe finishing emails and consolidating finances. Despite my disdain for goodbyes, a few close friends persuade me into a final dinner before heading to the airport. After dinner, I hand over my final key, the last remaining physical connection to the business I nearly buried myself to build. I know the members of the gym. My friends are in good hands. From this point forward, I no longer hear the jingle in my pocket that represents the responsibility which comes with a set of keys. Like most people, I was in the habit of tapping my left and right front pockets and back right pocket every time I went anywhere. Wallet, check. Keys, check. Phone, check. Now, here I am, without two of the three. I no longer own a key, something I haven't claimed since I was 6 years old. Keys are an amazing symbol for responsibility. Find a person with more than a few keys, and I'll show you a person burdened by obligation. No need to remember when to change the oil in the truck. No checking the mail. No waking up at 4:30 in the morning to open the doors for the first customers of the day. A small yet significant device in the grand scheme of things. A key is a light object made heavy with the responsibility it brings. I'd be lying if I said there isn't a certain degree of terror and self-doubt in this moment. My good friend and now former roommate Iason offers to drive me to the airport. I can tell he's excited for me by the way he talks, fast and filled with enthusiasm for the future. A quick curbside hug and bidding good luck, and Yasin's taillights fade into the darkness of the evening, leaving me to take the first steps of my solo journey of self-discovery. Moving closer to the gray counter manned by the feigned smile of an exhausted airline attendant, I can't help but feel I'm stepping closer to the edge of a cliff. The flickering fluorescent lights of Denver International Airport buzz overhead as I learn my first of many travel lessons. Entering Costa Rica on a one-way flight is not legal. I am completely unaware of something called onward travel. Apparently, travelers have to prove they will be leaving the country within 90 days of arriving. I canceled service to my phone earlier today, forcing me to try to find Wi-Fi in an effort to purchase another ticket out of Costa Rica. I haven't even made it to my gate, and I'm already messing this up. Perhaps this is a bad idea. Is it possible I've made a colossal mistake? The tides of life pull me toward departure. A long time ago, I learned not to swim against life's current. The time is now or never. This chance won't come again. The last-minute $800 expense for a return ticket I won't use kicks me in the gut, but nothing will keep me from boarding this plane. By the time I arrive at the terminal gate, the plane is already boarding. I have 3 minutes to just sit still, plug my headphones in, and listen to one last song before handing the freshly printed boarding pass to another overworked airline employee. The wheels jar and bounce and eventually find their way into the plane's underbelly. Unsteady at first. What a taken-for-granted mode of transport. A mesmerizing and godlike feat not long ago. A parody of an angel. There's no turning back now. Whether I've just made the biggest mistake or best decision of my life is yet to be seen. Either way, there is no changing it now. My eyes are heavy, but my mind is full. That restless, chaotic mind begins to really think about the weight of the situation. It's all gone. All of those heavy, earthly possessions that weighed me down are now the concern of someone else. Whatever tomorrow brings is completely unknown. It's terrifying and exhilarating and liberating all at once. As the thoughts of uncertainty begin to slowly dissipate and my eyes begin to close for the first time in over 36 hours, the elderly man to my left asks my name. It's Leo. Going to Costa Rica for a bit? Yeah, you could say that. Where are you staying? I'm not sure yet. I figured I'd think about that after I land. You don't say. Do you speak Spanish? Not really. How long will you be staying? I'm not sure. I guess as long as I feel like it's the right place for me to be. Wow. That sounds like quite the adventure. My wife and I recently retired, and we love going to Costa Rica for a few weeks. What do you do, Leo? Well, I guess I'm retired, too. The elderly man chuckles in disbelief. Despite the foot-long red beard covering my face, I don't look anywhere close to the age typical for a retiree. I'm eager to explain my situation with the couple occupying the seats next to me. The plane taking flight becomes a new chapter in my life, and these are the first people I get to share it with. From this point forward, the statement, "Where I lay my head is home," couldn't be more accurate. That being said, these two are now my new neighbors. I tell the story about selling my possessions and my gym and my visceral desire to travel and meet new people. It's evident from their facial expressions that they, in large part, write off my story to youthful ignorance and reckless abandon. After all, it doesn't make sense to my retiree seatmates to sell a successful business in your early 30s to simply go be in the world. The 5-hour flight passes so quickly that I never get to sleep. This is the third consecutive night without sleep, yet the excitement of landing in a new place keeps me alert and energetic. What a drastic change in scenery from the snow-covered buildings from where I just departed to landing in a tropical paradise boasting an endless sea of lush green palm leaves. The reality of the situation hits me like a 2-ton truck when I step into the wall of heat and humidity lurking past the doors of San Jose International Airport. I'm overwhelmed by dozens of men who holler, "Taxi! You need taxi!" Something hits me. I quickly realize I don't know anyone here. I just landed in a country where I don't speak the language and don't have a plan. Until this point, I'd spent all of my energy facilitating the selling of my property and getting away. I hadn't thought much about what I'd do immediately upon landing. Unlike past experiences arriving at an airport, no familiar face waits at the curb to pick me up. I push past the crowd of cab drivers to nowhere in particular. I wander around the airport with the giant red backpack, searching for anything that resembles a path I can set out on. It never occurred to me before, but airports typically aren't designed with the idea of leaving by foot. Chapter 3. Pura Vida. The best way to find out if you can trust somebody is to trust them. Ernest Hemingway. Unsure of what to do, I take a short tactical pause and flop my pack on the curb. Well, this is what you wanted. Complete and utter freedom to go wherever you desired. Now, what are you going to do with it? I've only been alone in the world for a few hours, and I'm already talking to myself. After a few moments, I decide there has to be a bus station nearby. The bus can take me to the beach. The idea of simply sleeping on the beach until I find a place to stay adds a layer of excitement to the situation. Walking back to the sea of soliciting cabbies, I see a couple of the guys from my flight. It seems evident they're on a short vacation looking to party. They rented a car and are finishing with the paperwork. Maybe I can get a lift with these guys. They must be headed toward the beach. Instead of striking up a conversation, I timidly execute a brief smile and head nod to acknowledge their presence and pass by. I'm not good at striking up conversations with strangers on the street. It's not a lack of personality. It's more like some misguided sense of pride keeping me from asking someone for a ride. Instead, I once again stand silently among the shouting taxi drivers. One man approaches me and in broken English asks, "What hotel are you staying at?" "I'm not sure," I reply without making eye contact. The man doesn't entirely understand, so he asks again, "What hotel?" "Yo necesito autobus station," I reply in what can only be described as terrible, broken Spanglish. "Oh, you go the bus?" the chubby, sweaty man inquires. "Yes, I want a bus to the beach, to Guanacaste." "It go 2 a day. It go soon. I take you. Vamos, vamos." I learn the bus station is a 20-minute taxi ride from the airport, and buses only leave for the coast twice a day. Additionally, the bus takes nearly 2.5 times as long to arrive at its destination due to frequent stops and slow mountain roads. I ask the cab driver, "How much will it cost to take your cab to the beach?" After about 2 minutes of bartering, the fare drops from $300 to $150. During my early 20s, I acquired the skill of bartering in the crowded bazaars during 3 combat deployments to Afghanistan. Just to make sure I get the best of the deal, I toss in the caveat that the driver give me basic Spanish lessons during the 3-hour drive, a condition he gladly accepts. As the car makes a sharp U-turn toward the beach, I hear my uncle repeating something from my childhood. "It only costs a nickel more to go first class." While the soothing sounds of Madonna playing in a rickety early 90s Hyundai for over 3 hours probably isn't what my Uncle Ron meant, it still feels good to not be on that chicken bus. A few miles past the airport, the car pulls to a stop at a roadside convenience store. I get out, despite being leery to exit the vehicle, which contains all my earthly possessions. I keep a sharp eye on the little red car the entire time we're in the shop. I consider going to the bathroom, but have the mental image of the heavy-set driver in his ill-fitting pants speeding away with all my gear. He asks if I am hungry, and points out that the back part of the store is actually a small coffee shop. With as clear of a view to the vehicle as possible, I sit down with hesitation for a much-needed meal. The cab driver introduces the dish as gallo pinto, or típico. I learned this is what Costa Ricans consider their typical breakfast dish, consisting of a couple of eggs, scrambled or fried, with rice and beans and occasionally a fried plantain. The rice is seasoned with some magical ingredient that makes it taste as gourmet as those swanky places that charge 4 times what food is worth, despite the fact it's served on a styrofoam plate. And the coffee? No contest, the coffee is easily 10 times better than anything people pay $6 for at Starbucks. Not having yet figured out what the conversion rate is, I pay with the yellow Monopoly money and get back a blue and a red Monopoly money and even some cool-looking pirate-type coins in return. Later, I find out the world's best cup of coffee cost about 70 cents. With all the accelerating power that a 22-year-old Sonata can muster, we depart and cruise through the hills, zipping around buses and rocking out to music made the same year as the shitty little car. I repeat, ¿Cómo se dice? How do you say? One of the only Spanish phrases I know during the drive. I point at an object and ask, ¿Cómo se dice? Eager to learn, I ask the poor guy how to say everything, and he's just as eager to teach. The food and the language of a nation are, to me, two of the largest contributing factors to cultural identity. I'm grateful to already be exposed to both. Part of the allure of this journey is the notion of disconnecting from the obstreperous tones on the World Wide Web. That was until I found out that there's Wi-Fi in the cab. That's when the language lesson stops and Facebook once again steals an opportunity to inherit a worldly experience. As we approach the northwest corner of Costa Rica, the green trees lining the road in the middle of the country begin to change shades. The humid air turns dry and the landscape begins to look more like Texas than the tropical paradise where we ate breakfast. We're only 40 minutes to the destination, but I can't hold it anymore. I've attempted to ignore the mounting bladder pressure since leaving our roadside coffee shop. Alto et el baño por favor. 2 years of high school Spanish, and that's all I can muster. Sad. What is left of the little red car's brakes screech to a stop at a gas station in the middle of nowhere. Now I'm left with a choice. Do I ask him to pop the trunk so I can grab my bag out and take it into the bathroom? Or do I trust this stranger? This man can easily drive away with everything I own if I step away from the car. I don't want to be rude and tell him to pop the trunk. Why does it matter, even if I appear rude? I choose to trust him. I have to trust a person whom I've never met in a part of the world I've never visited. I rush to the bathroom on the back side of the dirty little building. I try to go as fast as I can, but the stream reaches terminal velocity. The thought of a self-induced hernia enters my mind. Try explaining that to a doctor in Spanish. Over a liter exits my bladder in a matter of seconds as I'm desperate to get back to the parking lot, fearing I just made a terrible mistake. Why would you leave everything you own in that cab? Rushing out of the filthy bathroom, my heart drops like an elevator with a severed cable. Where the fuck is the cab? It's that sinking feeling you get when you see red and blue flashing lights in your rearview, but so much worse. My mind screams at my body to move forward, but the situation produces a paralytic effect. What seems like a lifetime is really little more than a few panicked breaths. Out of the corner of my eye, a familiar figure appears. That glorious, chubby, sweaty, brown-skinned man emerges from around the corner.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?